The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2020 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up on today's programme, we're live in St Moritz as some of the world's sharpest minds gather for Monocle's conference, The Chiefs. Also coming up, the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden warns of the UK jeopardising peace in Northern Ireland. And then the return of an institution to help Australia out of the COVID pandemic.
The Australian Design Council has been relaunched, and like the initial group formed in 1958, it's hoping to use design thinking to recharge the nation's economy. You'll hear more on that from me, Monocle's Nick Manise.
Plus Andrew Muller and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Enjoy a weekly rummage through the top 10 songs somewhere in the world. That's all coming up on The Briefing, live from London with me, Emma Nelson. The world is ripe and ready for restarting and looking ahead. So where better to get a clear and uninterrupted view than from the eastern Swiss Alps? And that is the setting for the Chiefs, Monocle's leadership conference, which welcomes visionaries, founders and industry leaders for a look ahead at how business and indeed the whole world can move forward from here. Well, our chief is Tyler Brulé, and he's stewarding us all through the day's event at Suvretta House in St Moritz. And I'm delighted to say he's taken a moment out of the conference to join us now to tell us what is happening where he is. Tyler, apart from the obvious attraction from the chairlift ride to an Alpine dinner, it must feel good to bring people together again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Emma. Absolutely. And I think that has been one of the probably overriding comments. People just said, God, this feels so good to be out in the world again and just meeting people in a setting which feels pretty normal. I don't think there's much going on here that would make you think otherwise, that we are still in the midst of course, we have cases rising in Europe. We have quarantines being imposed and borders also going up as well. So I think that has been really one of the key pieces. People are just happy to be together and to be listening to great ideas and I think also to be challenged a little bit as well.
Well, tell us a little bit more about these challenges, because people are coming back together facing momentous challenges. What is it that we're all trying to focus on here?
Well, a number of things. We just had Nora Feilbaum. Nora Feilbaum is the CEO of Vitra, of course, one of the world's most respected design brands. I imagine many, many listeners right now are quite likely sitting on a Vitra sofa or chair or stool or in front of a desk. So, you know, here's a business which is completely, focused on the topic of what is going to happen to our city centers. Will work from home account for 50% of the workforce? Is it going to be 20%? So we tackled that issue with her. And it was interesting, she was talking about, are we maybe moving into a world of hub and spoke? Yes, there'll be a main office in a city, but will there almost be more like owned and operated co-working spaces where people come together? So that was one topic. But then we just had Peter Maurer. He's the head of the ICRC, the International Committee for the Red Cross. And he was looking at the current crisis, the fact that we have a pandemic, Emma, but of course, the 30 messy parts of the world, as he talked about, this hasn't gone away. And he's just literally almost fresh off the plane from a mission in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso in the Sahel region.
What I find interesting is the names of the people you've gathered there. We obviously have World of Vitra, but then we have the head of security policy in the Swiss Federal Department of Defence, Civil Protection and Sport. You mentioned there we have the head of the Red Cross. These are figures from the world of dealing with emergencies. Does that reflect the kind of times that we're in?
Well, it does, because I think if you're going to have an informed view about risk and where the world is going, then I think you do need people who are at the pointy end. And that pointy end might be, how is a small but very economically successful like country like Switzerland, how is it going to navigate geopolitical issues? Why does Switzerland potentially need 40 new fighter aircraft at a time when people talk of drones and a country which is known as being neutral? And at the same time, you know, you also want to hear from someone who's the head of risk for one of the biggest banks, who can, of course, apply some of these elements as well to, of course, the end consumer, the person who wants to go and buy products from that bank. And how does that impact your day-to-day?
How far are we able to look ahead at the moment? I mean, is what we're talking about today stuff that we need to deal with at that pointy end in the next 6 months to 1 year? Or is there any sense yet that people can think a little further ahead?
Well, I think actually Nora Feilbaum was interesting, because someone posed a similar question about, you know, short term. What are you doing right now with marketing budgets? How do you look at advertising? How do you promote a brand right now? How do you stay top of mind? And then what do you do long term? And her response was, we're a family company from Basel. We have time. And so, of course, we continue to develop and invest in great furniture, and we take a long term view. You also have to be mindful of the realities of today as well.
I mean, there are issues that a little later on in the conference you'll be talking about the chiefs of the future when you talk about sustainability. And, you know, yesterday the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, was saying that we will rebuild our way out of the COVID pandemic following an entirely green agenda. Mm. But when you have things like, you know, your order book isn't as full as it should be, your staff are coming back from furlough, and you're thinking, how am I going to make it through the next 6 months? And people are saying, actually, you need to be greener. You need to think about this. You need to think about that. I mean, the priorities become quite challenging, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that is one of the topics. I mean, how much does, you know, you could talk about sustainability all you want, but, you know, does your program, which of course has the best intentions, does that maybe need to take a back seat for a while, because, you know, that was going to involve retooling your factory? You knew that it was going to actually mean, of course, upping the prices or accepting a more expensive supply chain. And so maybe that has to get not kicked into the grass necessarily, but it maybe has to drift out maybe 3 years, according to your plan. And I think that is also something we've heard, you know, today as well. You know, if you're going to do it, these things aren't easy. A lot of it is, let's walk it first before we talk and try to either talk up green credentials or sustainability agenda. And I think actually, and on that, probably the one thing that I think is really coming out of the conference so far is let's invest in things that last. And it, you know, it's interesting, you know, here you have Ms. Feilbaum talking about, you know, if you go and buy an Eames chair, and I believe you're probably sitting in an Eames chair right now, if I know what studio you're in, those come with a 30-year guarantee. And that's extraordinary. And, you know, that has to be now. And again, you know, is the entire chair perfectly sustainable? No. But it's not something you're going to bin in 5 years either.
It's absolutely not. And it's been comfortable for a very long time. Tyler, finally, looking ahead to this afternoon, you're taking the floor, talking to us about a few things that have caught your eye that you like and that have inspired you. I mean, we have to be lifted out of this somehow. What are you going to be talking about then?
Well, after lunch, I do a bit of a spin round the world, and of course, look at some things that, basic things that I experience in everyday life, which I think are interesting that we might need more of. So, and you, I think probably one thing, I was going through the slides, Emma, and you'll appreciate this. There's a lot of Austria in there. The world maybe needs a little bit, you know, even though, of course, I'm standing in Switzerland at the moment. But if I look across the mountains, if I look across the border, I know that Austria lies beyond. And there's definitely, whether it's brands, whether it's little urban interventions, the world needs also a little bit more Austria.
Full of wisdom there, Tyler Brulé. And I'm sitting next to our affairs editor, Chris Chermak, who is half Austrian. I've never seen more enthusiastic thumbs up in all my days. Tyler. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
for joining
Emma. Bye bye.
We'll be having more from the Chiefs Conference in St Moritz tomorrow morning and plenty of reports from the sessions over the next few weeks here on Monocle 24. In a moment, why the US Democrats have spoken out against plans for the UK to override parts of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, plus Andrew Muller and Fernando Augusto Pacheco wrestle it out over the world's top five music charts. But first, with the time 9 minutes past midday here in London, a quick summary of the latest world news headlines with Yulin Goffin.
Thanks, Emma. Aides to the Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny say he was poisoned by a bottle of water in his hotel room in Siberia and not at the airport as they previously believed. Navalny fell ill last month on a domestic flight bound for Moscow, which had to make an emergency landing. New Zealand has gone into its deepest recession in decades. It follows measures introduced to cut the spread of COVID-19. GDP shrank by 12.2% between April and June. It is the first recession in New Zealand since the global financial crisis. And Australia has recorded its lowest one-day rise in new COVID-19 cases in nearly 3 months. The country has now recorded nearly 27,000 COVID-19 infections and over 800 deaths. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Emma.
Thank you very much indeed, Yolene. Now, the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has warned that peace in Northern Ireland must not become a casualty of Brexit. It follows plans by the UK government to break certain terms of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, and some argue this could jeopardise the Northern Ireland peace agreement in turn. Well, to tell us more and explain why the United States is getting involved so closely, I'm joined by the political journalist and author Terry Stiasny and Monocle Affairs editor Chris Chermak. Welcome both. Good to have you on the programme. Hello, Terry. Just recap the Northern Ireland withdrawal agreement issue here, please. I know it's complicated, but would you mind bringing everybody up to speed, please?
Well, the issue is that the British government has got a bill which is called the UK Internal Market Bill, which is supposed to sort out the arrangements between the different parts of the UK once Brexit properly happens at the end of this year. Now, when this was being discussed in the House of Parliament last week, the Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis stood up and said that he believed that this bill would break international law in a specific and limited way. And of course, this caused an absolute uproar. There was a great amount of dissent among the Conservative benches as well, particularly among lawyers and among several former prime ministers who said, well, you can't just go around saying that you are going to break international law. Particularly, people were worried about the Northern Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement, and the impact that it would have on that. So there have been a great deal of criticism from people like former prime ministers, Sir John Major and Tony Blair, who were, of course, you know, part of forming that agreement. Now, Boris Johnson has fended off a bit of his own internal rebellion on that score. But obviously, when the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, was in Washington, this came up as an issue. And shortly after his meetings with Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden sent this tweet, and it seems to have put people's backs up a great deal in Washington.
Chris, what is the issue that the Americans are so concerned about in terms of breaking the terms of the Northern Ireland Agreement? I mean, it was partially broken or heavily involved in the whole process was Bill Clinton. So, I mean, the Americans have such a close involvement in this, don't they?
They absolutely do. And that's what makes this very interesting. I think when you look at the American politicians, all the reactions that we've seen over the last couple of days, they take a very broad brush approach, right? It's not for the U.S., for someone like Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, a whole bunch of congressmen, or four congressmen, I should say, that sent a letter to Boris Johnson about this. All of their messages have been very clear and simple. We do not want the Good Friday Agreement to be threatened in any way. That is the priority for the U.S. However narrow this breaking of international law might be that Terry was talking about, that is the priority for Joe Biden. Joe Biden himself is an Irish-American. So, you know, there is a constituency there in the U.S. And what's interesting is, therefore, this really is quite a bipartisan issue. Even Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, when he met with Dominic Raab, he put it in a slightly less threatening way, if you will, than some of the Democrats like Joe Biden have, who specifically said, you know, under our watch, there will be no U.S.-UK trade deal if Good Friday is threatened. But even Mike Pompeo said, you know, we adhere to the Good Friday Agreement. We are confident that the UK will not be breaking that agreement going forward.
Chris, explain to me a little bit more in depth about what the Americans are worried about. Are they worried about the fact that by reneging on some parts, intending to break some parts of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, the United Kingdom government could effectively reimpose border controls between the within the island of Ireland, thus possibly provoking goodness knows what kind of reaction? Or are they more concerned about the fact that the United Kingdom, the country which many people say invented the rule of law, are quite happy to openly start to break with the whole system of agreement?
You know, in terms of the reactions I've seen so far, you would think it would be the latter to some degree, but it's more been focused on the former. It's really been focused on Ireland and this concern about a hard border being created between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And this just goes to show for me that, you know, the US is in an interesting or tricky position, because even Donald Trump, the Trump administration, in many ways, you know, has been almost openly in favor of Brexit. And Mike Pompeo also issued some positive words saying, you know, the UK voted for this and we expect this to come to fruition and we stand there to support it. But at the same time, there is a very strong Irish constituency in the US as well. And so Irish concerns always play up very strongly in the US, in the US political scene and internationally at the same time. And so that's really where the focus has been, far more than on this idea of international law being broken. Perhaps I would submit that that's partly because the US doesn't have such a strong leg to stand on these days when it comes to its international treaties.
Terry, you mentioned that the British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been trying to reassure the US politicians about the latest Brexit developments during a trip to Washington. Is there any sense that he's actually succeeded?
Well, when he was in Washington, he was saying that this action by the UK is defensive, precautionary, proportionate. I think, you know, because Joe Biden's reaction came after some of his meetings, it suggests that, you know, certainly in terms of the Democrats, he didn't do that great a job. And, you know, obviously, you know, he was talking to people in government as well. I think one of the interesting things from on this side in terms of the UK reaction has been the strength of the reaction of some Conservative MPs who support Brexit to Joe Biden's tweet. I mean, John Redwood, for instance, was saying things like trade deals are nice to have, but they're not essential. And just recently, the former Conservative leader, Ian Duncan Smith, has told The Times, he said, "We don't need lectures on the Northern Ireland peace deal from Mr. Biden. If I were him, I would worry more about the need for a peace deal in the USA to stop the killing and rioting before lecturing other sovereign nations." So I can't imagine that is going to exactly be helpful in this circumstance, that kind of reaction. Some other MPs saying that, well, this is just all about the Irish-American vote. But I think that's a particularly provocative intervention from Ian Duncan Smith.
Well, speaking of provocative interventions, yesterday the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was asked about the whole involvement of the American political sphere into effectively what is a row between the EU and the UK. And it appeared that he actually accused Nancy Pelosi of getting her facts wrong.
Well, have they got it wrong? Has Nancy Pelosi got it wrong? Does Nancy Pelosi have it wrong? Is she wrong? Is Nancy Pelosi wrong in that assertion with the four chairpersons
of
Britain?
Possibly the vital importance of protecting the symmetry of the Good Friday Agreement is something that may have been lost so far in the presentation of this matter.
Chris, given what... And I had my head in my hands, I must confess. Given what Terry has just said in terms of the pushback from domestic politics, and then, you know, for the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to basically say that Nancy Pelosi has got her facts wrong, I would possibly perhaps caution against that. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I think what is interesting about this is the fact that we have seen this before. And I was very much reminded of Barack Obama back in 2016 when he gave a very strong intervention ahead of the Brexit referendum, saying that the UK would be at the, quote, back of the queue when it came to trade deals if they voted for Brexit. How did that work out? Not particularly well. Some could argue that, like you're hearing from someone like Ian Duncan Smith now, it galvanized the Conservatives in the UK. It galvanized the pro-Brexit camp. So in that sense, I would say, you know, foreign interventions in this kind of direct way, the US has clear interests, as I talked about, also political interests in upholding the values and the rights of Ireland in all of this. Will their intervention be helpful? I think we're seeing from some of these UK reactions that it's not necessarily going to be a positive contribution. This has to be sorted out at the end of the day between the UK and the European Union.
Terry, your thoughts on this, the potential that things could get much, much worse before they get better?
Well, I think, as Chris says, I mean, the problem for the UK government is they're going to have to deal with whoever is in power in the US after the next election. So it's really in their interest to, I suppose, to play both sides slightly at the moment, or at least not to turn this into a much bigger row. I think in terms of where Boris Johnson is, his immediate problem in terms of a rebellion on his own side has died down slightly. He has got some kind of a compromise on that. What's going to happen after that, though, is once this goes through the House of Commons, he will still have big problems in the House of Lords. He also lost one of the senior law officers, the Advocate General for Scotland, yesterday, who basically said that he couldn't reconcile his obligations as a law officer with the government's policy, and said they didn't even have a respectable argument. So, and I think he's also getting criticism now in terms of a lack of grasp, a lack of attention to detail, and a lack of leadership. And I think this kind of firefighting and going from one crisis to another, particularly with coronavirus going on, they need to get a bit more grip on these issues and not just be saying one thing one day and something else the next day.
Terry Stiasny and Chris Chermak, as ever, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Briefing. . 13:21 in Zurich, 12:21 here in London, not long before Andrew Muller and Fernando Augusto Pacheco thrash it out over the pop charts. But first, Australia has re-established its Design Council. It says it'll bring together the nation's top captains of industry, innovators, entrepreneurs and thinkers to reshape the nation post-COVID-19. Well, Monocle's Nick Moniz, one of our design writing team, and who also just happens to be Australian, joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Nick. The council is back, which begs the question, what happened to it in the first place to make it go away?
But before we even go into that, I guess we want to jump way, way back. It was first established as the Industrial Design Council in 1958. And basically, I guess its initial efforts were to try and maintain and promote high standards in Australia's manufacturing sector. But then over the course of 30 years, it transformed more broadly into the Australian Design Council and then was disbanded in 1991. The exact reason for this was that it was absorbed by Australian standards, which I guess they cover everything in terms from manufacturing to the actual construction of buildings, to ensure that there's quality and that quality is being built into things. And it's obviously re-emerged this year. They feel that there's a need for this. Good Design Australia, who run Australia's annual Good Design Awards, are going to oversee the newly re-emerged council, and essentially they're going to try and champion good design in Australia.
What is their remit here? I mean, clearly this is a reaction to what's happened post-COVID or currently through COVID, in the same way that the Australian Design Council was kind of inspired by what the UK Design Council did at the end of the Second World War. This is one of these situations where you have an enormous crisis in front of you, and design is the way out of it.
Yeah, and I think it's important to be clear that we're not talking about design in terms of architects landscape architects, industrial designers making things. We're talking about a design thinking approach to business. So it runs the gamut of all sectors, you know, from architecture and design and construction all the way through to, I guess, science and computing and technology. And much like, I guess, trying to rebuild the economy post-war, post the Second World War, they're trying to use that sort of design thinking, that approach, that strategic considered approach to business to help rebuild Australia's economy following this pandemic.
So what is this actually going to look like?
That is a very good question, and that's one of my favourite things. I think that's one of those, sometimes the it's maybe not an issue, because I think it is a really, really good thing, but when you start to look at, I guess, a nationwide approach to solving things, it can end up in a lot of, I guess, talkitecture, if you want to put it in architecture terms, where I'm not sure if I'm seeing actions or just people talking about the need to rebuild the economy. But what they are doing, and they are going to take some initial steps. They're establishing the Australian Design Challenges, so they're going to be inviting people to respond to briefs to look to, I guess, rebuild and rethink their businesses in ways that might actually help them grow.
Thank you very much indeed for joining me in the studio, Nick Moniz. You're with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Finally, it's time to enjoy our weekly rundown of a top 10 somewhere in the world. And there's a slight change of plan for the regular hosts, Andrew Muller and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. They normally focus on one country. But this week, there has been a global countdown of music of the top 10 and top 5. So may I present to you the global countdown.
It is that time of a Thursday again, specifically time for Fernando Augusto Pacheco's Global Countdown. Regular listeners will be familiar with the dynamic in which Fernando brings in the top five from a given jurisdiction, tells me they're going to be fantastic, and this week I'm really going to enjoy them, and that literally never happens. So here once again to play Lucy Van Pelt holding the football to my keenly running up Charlie Brown, a Peanuts reference there for anybody who missed it, is Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And I know you say this every week, Fernando, and I sigh when you say it every week, but it's a special global countdown this week. Apparently, it says here.
It is incredibly special. I know I say this quite often, but you know, Billboard, they are, you know, they usually publish every week the North American charts, the US charts, but now they are going global. So from this week onwards, every week we're going to have the Billboard Global 200.
Can we sue them?
Probably, you know, because we are having this idea before.
Exactly.
Well, but to be honest, I mean, the executive saying, you know, it's been very hard to have a global chart. They've been working on this for years. But I think now, so they're going to calculate the streaming and the downloads of more than 200 territories. And, you know, it's been a hard. So, for example, they're not counting radio airplay and they're having two different charts. I'm going to use the Global 200.
Okay.
But there's one with the US included and another one without the US.
So we're doing with the US included?
We're doing with the US.
Okay. It's fair enough.
Properly global. And again, there's a lot of different statistics here. I mean, 60% of the artists are still from the US when you look at the whole list. But then we have the UK with 10% and Puerto Rico with 5%.
Get out of town, really? Puerto Rico.
Exactly. So
good for Puerto Rico.
But let's start with number five. We're heading actually to Canada, Andrew, and a little bit the US as well. It's Drake featuring Lil Durk with Laugh Now, Cry Later. I know that they at the crib going crazy down bad. What they had didn't last, damn baby. Sometimes we laugh, sometimes we cry, but I guess you know now. Baby, I took a half and she took the whole thing, slow down.
See, the thing is, Fernando, about the global top five, it's all going to be those songs that turn up in at least once in all our other charts every week, because there are some artists that do have that absolutely inescapable global reach, and those are the artists that the taxi driver is always playing at deafening volume when you get into the cab after getting off the plane.
You're very right. I mean, in fact, our number four song we played last week when we had to Colombia, remember that?
I have tried to blot it out, Fernando, with a course of all kinds of suppressants, which I won't worry details with the listeners of. I do vaguely remember the Colombian top five, yes.
Just be mindful not saying anything bad about him, because I'm kind of a bit of a fan.
Okay.
It's Maluma. He's actually from Medellin. The song's called Hawaii. And remember, it's actually a very sad song. It's about a relationship that did not work out. But he's still looking great in the video. But let's hear the song.
I remember that now. That was the one where I said I couldn't say I blamed her, wasn't it?
Exactly. Well, and you were surprised there when I mentioned Puerto Rico being the third country in terms of artists in the charts.
So that is genuinely an amazing, extraordinary fact. That is something I did not know when I woke up this morning.
Yeah, well, they are a music powerhouse. I mean, they are ahead, if you think about it, of, you know, after you have Canada, Colombia, Japan, South Korea, which countries there are bigger,
yeah,
and you would presume they would have more artists. But number three, we have 24 Golden, K Golden, which is from the US, featuring Yan Dior from Puerto Rico. The song's called Mood. Why are you always in the mood? Fuck around like you're brand new. I ain't trying to tell you what to do, but try to play cool. Baby, I ain't playing by your rules. Everything look better with a view. I can never get attached when I start to feel I'm attached. Somehow I was in the film.
Are there lots of expensive cars in the video? I get that vibe from
there
it.
There are. And number five, I even forgot to say, there were a lot of jet skis as well. There's always jet skis. It's still a thing, apparently.
Okay. I was going there to make extraordinary, damning and swinging judgment upon the sort of person who rides jet skis. But we may have a large jet ski community among our listenership who I do not wish to upset. So I will keep my opinions about jet skiers to myself for the moment.
Maybe it's better this way. And Andrew, I mean, number two is from South Korea, is BTS. But before I introduce the song, I have to say here, I think recently we've been reading in the media, oh, the rise of K-pop. But I think some of those articles, I mean, K-pop already rose a few years ago. That's an old story.
Regrettably, yes. But we did talk about this a while back, didn't we? When is this the one that was their US number one? The first
exactly.
time a Korean band had gone to the United top of the United States charts? See, Fernando, I do listen.
And it's a shame they had to sing in English for it. But let's hear it.
Well, one could argue it's a shame they had to sing at all. But nevertheless.
BTS who dynamited number two.
Yeah, it's not growing on me.
But
it's never likely to.
But number one is the kind of song that even if you're not a fan of hip-hop, I mean, you have to admire, because this is the kind of song that attracts, you know, hatred from politicians. They hate it, especially from conservative parties. And you would say, oh, this still exists? Yes, it does.
So is this one of those things where even if you don't like the actual record all that much, and let's face it, I'm not going to, you can at least enjoy that it is winding up all the right people?
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yes. And again, this year we've been having a lot of collaborations between female rappers, and they're finally breaking the charts. Of course, I'm not saying something new, but, you know, they are reaching number one. And this song is number one globally,
not only
in the US.
I was just going to say that we should pause for a moment's reflection, although not actually pause, because on radio that just doesn't work at all. But we should acknowledge that this is actually weirdly kind of history-making, isn't it? This is the first ever official, actual, global number one.
Absolutely. And I think Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, they're going to be very happy. The song is WAP. Yeah, you tellin' with some wet and gushy. Bring a bucket and a mop for this wet and gushy. Give me everything you got for this wet and gushy. Now from the top, make it drop, that's some wet and gushy. Now get it.
What's it about, Fernando?
Well, it's the edited version, of course. I mean, and again, if listeners want to know more about WAP, I would say Google it.
Not on a work computer, right?
Maybe not on a work computer, even though I had to do it because, you know, that's my job, Andrew.
Well, you tell the judge that.
But I love that song, actually. I think it's strangely addictive. But that's the whole top five. I think it's quite interesting. We have US, South Korea, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Canada. Quite international in a way.
I think having gone global this week, if I can make a request for next week, I want somewhere really just maddeningly obscure.
I will take your offer.
Excellent. And we will talk then. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you as always.
And thanks also to Andrew Muller for that conversation. That's all we have time for today's edition of The Briefing. Many thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie and Yolene Goffin, and our studio manager, Nora Hoel. A little later at 2100 hours here in London, that's 1600 if you're listening in New York, and indeed 2200 in Zurich, we will have the late edition. We'll have more from the Chiefs Conference in St. Moritz as Monocle brings together the sharpest minds to work out the next steps in the world. The Briefing is back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join us for that. That's at midday London time, 1300 in Zurich. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.